It's like their brains were no good. A classic, hey. Well, let's see if our brains are any good today, shall we? We're going to engage with this story. Now, we've been working our way through the Gospel of Mark. It's been a really great series. We're going to continue through it next year as well. And as we work through the various Gospels, we're going to find a number of stories that occur on water. And each of these stories that occurs on water actually carries with it a different lesson. So I want to make it really clear in terms of the story that we are engaging with today. This is a different story to Jesus calming the storm. That's a different story to the one we engage with today. And I want to make it clear, this story we're engaging with today is different to the story of Peter walking on the water. Because they're the two stories that we often associate with water, right? And this story, while it has some similarities and maybe some connections, is a different story with a different lesson for us. And so I want us to work through the text because I'm really excited with what I have to share today, because to a certain extent, I'm still working it out too. This is one of those messages that as I prepared for it, it kept doing a work in me and I'm like, is that it? I thought I had it. Actually, maybe it's that. And today, I think and I hope that you might find something similar. And I think that's the beauty of engaging with this living word. New revelation arises and we go, God, is that what you have for me? So let's work through this text. It says, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida while he dismissed the crowd. Now, this is just following what we classically call the feeding of the 5,000. After leaving them, he went up on a mountainside to pray. Later that night, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and he was alone on land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. Shortly before dawn, he went out to them walking on the lake. He was about to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost. They cried out because they all saw him and were terrified. Immediately he spoke to them and said, take courage, it is I, don't be afraid. Then he climbed into the boat with them and the wind died down and they were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. When they had crossed over, they landed at Gennesaret and anchored there. As soon as they got out of the boat, people recognized Jesus. Now I heard a few little kind of almost little spatterings of laughter along the way, and we're definitely going to pick up on all those spatterings of laughter because this is a story that is filled with things that we expect not to occur in a Jesus story. And I'm not talking about the water on walking on water one, okay? But I want to start by thinking about this bizarre twist ending that we have here. So we get to the kind of conclusion of this story. It's all kind of happened. And the way that this gospel describes the disciples is that they were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. This is the culmination of the story. And up to this point, I don't think we've talked about bread, right? Isn't this a story of Jesus walking on the water? Isn't this a story about something else? What does this story have to do with the loaves? And why does the author of this gospel make it really clear that they were completely amazed? It doesn't even say what they were specifically amazed at. But they were completely amazed, for they had not understood about the loaves. So where did this come from? Now, this is really, this message in some ways is like part two of what Dave Clark shared last week, because there is a direct connection in Gospel of Mark between the feeding of the 5,000 and this story of Jesus walking on water. It's actually the same lesson that's being taught, even through starkly different stories. So in case you or me or like the disciples missed it the first time, we're going to engage with it again. We're going to give it a second go. Because we know that this is a lesson. How do we know that this is a lesson that Jesus was trying to teach his disciples? It's because they ended up at a different destination to where he had instructed them to go. That's just a clue. He told the disciples to go to Bethsaida. This event happened. They didn't understand about the loaves. And where did they end up? At Gennesaret. You see, it would make sense if they ended up at the place where Jesus told them to go if it were just about going to a place. But actually, Jesus wanted, like any good rabbi, to teach his disciples a lesson that they would need, not just for that moment, but for the ministry that would extend out of them. Jesus was preparing his disciples for the mission. And all the way through Mark chapter 6, we see this, him preparing them for the mission that would ultimately be theirs and is ours today. And so this message in particular, I think, will resonate with a few people here. Because it may be that you are struggling to respond to the needs around you. It just seems like there's too much need. You might be seeking to faithfully live out the way of Jesus. Like, you're really trying to live out his way, the best way. But it's really, really hard. The message in here will resonate with you. You see, I have seen Christians sometimes who struggle to understand the reality of pain. And sometimes we can get this message, and maybe you were brought up with this message, or maybe this message somehow kind of embedded within you, that the way of Jesus is the easiest way. It's not the easiest way. Rather than perhaps what I would describe as the deepest, richest way to live. And we can so easily confuse the two, and let me make it clear, this passage will speak to that very reality. Because Jesus wants us to ask the question, do we understand the loaves? So I want to first talk about parts of this story that are confusing to us as followers of Jesus. Now, let me make something really, really clear. We're not trying to, and I know this is a little controversial for some, we're not trying to what they call harmonize the Gospels. That is where you take all the Gospels and you overlay them all on top of each other and try to make it all kind of work. Okay, that's not what the Gospel writers intended, and that's not what we're going to do today. What we're looking for in a gospel, a good news, is what is the truth that is being communicated to its audience, right? Because that's what the author had in mind. And so, like all biblical texts, this narrative, this story, it actually speaks on multiple levels. Because yes, Jesus, in a very specific and real time in history, was teaching his band of disciples, right, a lesson. Like, that actually happened in history. But also, they weren't the intended recipients of this gospel, right? They were experiencing it in real time with Jesus, but actually this gospel was written to other people as well. And so the gospel writer would write this story to communicate some sort of truth to those who would be reading it and wanting to hear, why is the way of Jesus good news? Equally for us today, we read this gospel and we say, God, what is it that you want to teach us about your way? And so these details that are in this story are not in there by accident, right? They are there for us to wrestle with, generating questions that this lesson seeks to answer. So let's start up here with our first one. It says, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida while he dismissed the crowd. And after leaving them, he went up onto a mountainside to pray. So Jesus sent his disciples ahead of him with this promise that he would come later or he would come soon. Now, this idea of a rabbi sending his disciples ahead of him, it was uncommon but not unprecedented, okay? The mentality of a rabbi was that the disciples would follow you, right? It was a following business. I wanted to watch what my rabbi did. There were historical examples where the disciples, the Talmudim, would literally follow their rabbi into the toilet block, right? Because they wanted to copy what their rabbi did. So the default position is, I am watching everything the rabbi does, my teacher, right? I want to imitate them. So the idea that Jesus actually tells them to go ahead of them is just a little bit strange. And unlike earlier in Mark chapter 6, where he deliberately commissions them to go ahead of him, bringing about the kingdom and preparing the way, this was more like, hey, just guys, get on the boat and go over. I'll catch up. So it's a little bit bizarre. And it raises a few questions, okay? How is Jesus going to get where he directed them? That's a reasonable question. Why did the disciples need to take a boat? And why do they need to row overnight? This raises a bunch of really interesting questions. Because I want us to note the distances we're talking about here. See, sometimes we picture huge distances traveling by boat. The places we're talking about at present, and they suspect he was around Capernaum at the time, somewhere Capernaum, and he was kind of saying, go to Bethsaida, and you can see where they end up. We're talking 10 Ks, 10 kilometers. Like some of you guys ran that this morning, right? We are not talking about big distances here. You could absolutely walk it. Right? You could absolutely walk it. So how was Jesus going to get there? I suppose he could have walked if they took the boat, but why did they need to take a boat? There was no need to take a boat, right? And why did they need to row overnight? Like, how was rowing and beginning rowing at nighttime going to assist them in this process? It just doesn't make any sense. And these kind of questions, like, why would Jesus send us out ahead of him, promising to come behind? And these kind of questions should actually be very familiar to us as followers of Jesus. Because we too are carriers of a promise, and we ask these same kind of questions. So when exactly, Jesus, are you going to show up? Right? We ask this question. Okay, Jesus, I know you want me to do this, but you expect me to use this particular vehicle? That is, like, work with this church, work with this particular team. Like, you want me to use this particular vehicle to do your work? Are you sure? It might be easier to walk, right? And we might even ask the question, so, Jesus, you want me to be obedient now? Like now? Because it would be much easier if it were lighter, right? So these kind of questions that this situation is presenting with us are really familiar, because we are like the disciples. We're going, I don't quite know when Jesus is coming, why we're taking a boat and why we're going now, but I am seeking to be obedient to Jesus. And let's just see what happens, right? This is very, very familiar. And so key to understanding this particular story, this setup here is going to be a very, very important idea for us to hold. But this is just the first of many bizarre things. Let's move on to the second one. Later that night, the boat was in the middle of the lake and he was alone, that's Jesus was alone, on the land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. And shortly before dawn, he went out to them walking on the lake. Now, some of you I can see here feeling very confident. You're like, Gavin, I know what the second confusing thing is. It's very obvious. How does he walk on water? That is a very good question. But I want to make it really clear that in every single gospel, the writer does not make a big deal about Jesus walking on water. That is not the big deal, which surprises us, because particularly as Western Christians, we love this idea of, like, oh, whoa, that's incredible, right? We love that gravity-defying Jesus move, right? But I want us to turn our attention to something that is actually far more profound, you could argue, in this passage, and that is the timeline. I want you to note this. The text says, later that night, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and Jesus was alone on the land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars, which again gives us a sense of how far we're talking in. Like, we're not talking far. He saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. So apparently Jesus was watching to see how it was going on the beach after having some lovely prayer time by himself. And then shortly before dawn, he went out to them walking on the lake. And this is the most important detail. Shortly before dawn. So may I ask the question, how long had the disciples been out there struggling on the lake? What are we talking? 4 hours? 6 hours? Shortly before dawn is the fourth watch of night. This is just before sunrise. Like, how long have they been straining against the oars, against this wind? They've been following Jesus' instructions and found themselves in this long and hard battle against the elements, while apparently their teacher is watching them from the sidelines. Are you getting a little uncomfortable yet? It's supposed to be uncomfortable because these details pose questions that the lesson seeks to answer. Okay? And how do we feel like the disciples? Oh, sorry, how might the disciples be feeling in this particular moment? Now, it doesn't say the disciples could see Jesus. I want to make that clear. And later in the story, they could only see him apparently at short proximity. But they must be feeling exhausted, tired, Did Jesus really ask us to take a boat? Did he really send us out at night? Maybe they're feeling cynical about the possibility of getting to Bethsaida. What was Jesus thinking as they strain against the oars? Because how long have they been out there? This is about a few years ago, but it came to mind as I was thinking about this story. A few years ago when the Todd flooded, we had someone who sought to do what people do sometimes, and that is drive through the river. Now, they got stuck, and they ended up on the top of their car, and then they ended up on a tree, and they had to cling to it for, quote, 6.5 hours. Now, I love this picture for a couple of reasons. One, because I do know that there were amazing people at the SES and other police there who were actively helping this man be rescued. But I also love this photo because you can't really see the guy very much. And part of it just looks like they're kind of standing there watching. And I've got to wonder how that guy's feeling, clinging to a tree for 6.5 hours. How did I find myself here, right? Sometimes it can feel like in our lives we are just clinging to a tree. And we're asking the question, Jesus, did you really call me here? Did you really call me to this time and this moment? And can I hold on any longer? It's hard to believe sometimes that God has our best in mind. And that best in mind may include struggle. Sometimes it's hard to believe God has our best in mind and that best in mind may include struggle. You might be here and saying, Jesus, I am tired. I've been working with this person in my workplace or relational circle for years, and I just don't know if I've got what it takes anymore. Or it might be that you're here and you're like, God, I know. Actually, I feel a deep conviction that you've placed me here in Alice Springs. Like, you've called me here. I know this is where I'm supposed to be. Your instructions are clear. But this challenge or this situation that I am facing is just so overwhelming, and it's bigger than my experience, and I'm scared. And in those moments, we're like clinging to the tree and we go, Jesus, will you rescue me? Will you rescue me? Because my grip's giving out. Because this is where Jesus, right, swoops in to save the day in the way that we expect, right? That's how it's supposed to go down. That's what we maybe have been taught, that Jesus always saves us from all of this temporary life struggles. He saw the disciples straining against the oars because the wind was against them, and shortly before dawn he went out to them walking on the lake. He was about to pass by them. He was about to pass by them. The writer makes it clear Jesus was going to walk by. Now, in case you go, oh, no. That's just, you know, you're not reading it correctly. Here we go. Let's have a look at some different translations, including the Greek. He meant to pass by them. He would have passed by them. He intended to go right by them. He intended to go past them and wished to pass by them. In the Greek, thelen parathein, he had in mind, intended to be resolved, even the desire to go past them. Oh. Isn't this fascinating? Story, man. So good. Now, let me make this clear. This story, the one we find in Mark, it does not say that they thought they were about to drown. Different story. Okay? It actually doesn't even say that there was a storm with big waves. Different story. This is why I said at the beginning, let's not confuse our stories. Okay? But in this story, it makes it very clear that Jesus intended to pass by. Why? I would argue it's because he wanted to know if they had learned the lesson of the loaves yet. Remember, it's about the loaves. Did we forget about that? Yeah? He wanted to know whether they had learnt the lesson of the loaves yet. Have we learnt the lesson of the loaves yet? He was about to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost. They cried out because they all saw him and were terrified. Immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take courage, it is I. Don't be afraid." Then he climbed into the boat with them, and the wind died down. This is his response to their circumstances, to the instruction, to the delay, to the fear, to the frustration. Jesus declares who he is. "Take courage, it is I. Don't be afraid." And then he climbs into the boat with them. In our fear, in our exhaustion, in our confusion, according to this gospel writer, the good news is that Jesus in those times reminds us who he is, and he climbs in the boat with us. Notice that it says, notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say that immediately the wind died down. It says immediately he spoke. And it doesn't say that Jesus spoke to the wind. It says that Jesus spoke to them. Let me say that again. It doesn't say that immediately the wind died down. It just says that he climbed to the boat and the wind died down. It says immediately he spoke to them in their circumstance. And he didn't speak to the wind in this story. He spoke to them and said, "Take courage, it is I, don't be afraid." Because for this gospel writer, this right here is good news for those reading or hearing this message. To the persecuted and the marginalized under Roman oppression in the first century, caught in this storm or wind that they didn't want to be in, paddling with limited energy but wanting to faithfully follow God, Jesus said to them, "Take courage, it is I, don't be afraid." To believers here in Alice Springs, facing incredible systemic challenges and isolation and working so hard, questioning the outcomes, perhaps exhausted, but wanting to faithfully follow Jesus, he says, "Take courage, it is I, don't be afraid." You see, this story is far less about God's power and far more about God's presence. And it's not that God isn't powerful, but this story is far more about God's presence than about his power. And their response, they were completely amazed, but they had not understood about the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. Do you understand the loaves yet? If you don't, that's okay. I was still working on it this week. You see, there's a risk that we read this story and we end up astounded with gravity-defying Jesus, and yet not truly understand, because we don't understand the loaves. Now, last Sunday, Dave Clark, great message. If you didn't hear it, make sure you catch up online. He spoke on this preceding story of the loaves, classically known as Jesus feeding the 5,000. Now, Dave pointed out something that's a bit nerdy, but is really profound, that the story has what we call a chiastic structure, right? And what it does is it points to the middle. Designed to point to the middle because in the middle is the treasure that the writer wants you to find. It's a literary tool. It's very, very common in Scripture. And he pointed out that it was somewhat underwhelming, the treasure in the middle. Jesus directed the people to sit down in groups on the green grass. But he pointed out that this was a clue, or what the rabbis would call a remez, a hint, right? That was designed to point and lead people to something that was familiar in the Old Testament, where this phrase or this image had been previously used. And he pointed out that this idea of being directed to sit down or lie down, in Hebraic thought, on green grass was something that many of us would be familiar with, and that is from Psalm 23, the Good Shepherd. And so with this story I just shared, with all those confusing parts, the instruction, the delay, the struggle, and all the questions, the temptation to cast Jesus as this hero that saves us from every struggle or challenge, I want you to listen to these words and see if it resonates. The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along the right paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Now, if you're not quite convinced that this story was connected to the loaves because of the explicit reference within it, then I want you to notice how, if the connection between the feeding of the 5,000 is connected with this psalm, how curious the details are that are within it that resonate with our story today. Isn't it interesting that it says, he makes me lie down in green pastures, and for the next line to say, he leads me beside quiet waters. As this story is resonating within them, they're trying to work out the loaves and they know this text in them. How bizarre that the next waters that they encounter are not quite so quiet until Jesus steps in. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, rowing for hours, I will fear no evil. I thought it was a ghost, for you are with me. Jesus declares, take courage, it is I, don't be afraid. Your rod and this staff, they comfort me. The rod and the staff, of course, being tools of protection for a shepherd. You see, the lesson of the loaves, the things that Jesus wanted the disciples to understand, who he was sending on mission and who he knew would carry this mission through difficult times and circumstances, I believe, is this. That in your suffering, the promise isn't that Jesus will always swoop in and save the day. And I'm sorry if that hurts. He may, in divine power, feed the crowd. He can and he did. He may, in divine power, walking on water, keep walking past that particular circumstance and struggle. But he is always the good shepherd who is with us in those struggles. That's the lesson of the loaves. We're all going to struggle. We're going to find ourselves exhausted. But do we understand how God works in this temporary life? Sometimes he chooses in divine power to heal people. I pray for people after the services all the time, and I know that other people do too. And sometimes he chooses to heal them, and sometimes he chooses not to.
but neither response makes him any less of the good shepherd who is with us in the midst of our struggles. And I've sat with people. I know someone who was pretty close to me who was down in Adelaide, and they went through a traumatic experience. Their friend went through an even more traumatic experience, and they were young, and that's okay. But Jesus didn't respond in the way that she wanted. She had some sort of checklist of things that she expected God to deliver on, and he didn't deliver that particular way. And so what ended up emerging from that experience was bitterness. And I haven't given up hope on her. God is still working in her life. But for me, it was this indication that maybe something was just off in the way that she understood struggle and God's presence in the midst of it. See, the invitation of the loaves is to not define our worth, our success and significance, or our peace on the external circumstances that we are facing and its frustrating limitations. The invitation is not to define God by whether or not he delivers the way that we want, but instead, as the psalmist says, to lack nothing, because God, the Good Shepherd, is with us both now and into eternity. As I wrap up, I take comfort from these words of Paul, who, like us, knew struggle, and he knew struggle in many ways. But he wrote these words to the church in Philippi. He said, I've learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all this through him who gives me strength. You see, things aren't always going to happen the way that we expect. But the Good Shepherd will provide, no matter the pastures or the waters, or the dark valleys that we experience. This is his promise. He says, I'll use what you have and multiply it how I see fit. Whether that be 5 loaves, 2 fish, or whether it be 6 hours on the oars, I will take what you have and I will multiply it how I see fit. And he'll declare, I am with you. Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid. And so I want just to complete this sermon with a little bit of time of reflection, because I realize we've traveled a fair bit of territory, and the stuff that I hit today can be like poking a bruise. And maybe some people, and I've done this at times too, so I'm not immune, you know. Somehow we've decided at some point or another that God's only delivered when he delivers the way that I want him to deliver. And we've just decided that in our mind. And so we're waiting for God to show up instead of recognizing that he's the Good Shepherd with us, wanting us to lack nothing even in the midst of the struggles. And so I'm going to ask a question, and I know it's hard for me, but I'm going to stop talking and take a moment for you to reflect on 2 questions, one at a time. This is the first question. I don't have it on the screen, underprepared. Is there an area of life right now that feels like faithful struggle? Faithful struggle. And with that in mind, how do you see God in that experience right now? Is there an area of life right now that you are lacking contentment? How do you see God in that? Jesus, you know, because you created us, that you made us to understand the lesson of the loaves. And God, whether right now we feel like we've been struggling against the wind for hours, or we've only got this menial amount of food to feed the crowds, may we not cast you simply in the part that we want, but would we acknowledge you as the Good Shepherd who is with us in the midst of those struggles? We get that, God. I want to pray if there's areas of life where we've relegated you to the sidelines or to the bad guy or even to the hero figure that we're just waiting on. Help us to see you differently, to talk to you, to take courage, to identify you, and to not be afraid. For this life, our lives are yours. In your name, amen.